¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Eye Studio with Helen Lewis, Ian Hislop and Richard Brooks. So we have just had an American import to the UK in the form of Saturday Night Live UK. It's, you know, a big American show that's come here after kind of 50 years. But we have just announced a really successful new export to America, which is the idea of having a Mad King. America's taken that on and they've been running with it. And Helen, I believe you've been following how well it's been going.
Yeah, I mean, so much winning. So obviously Donald Trump, I'm hesitant to say anything about the Iran war because it's existing in this sort of quantum superposition of whatever Donald Trump says is currently happening with it. He currently says he's negotiating with the Iranians. The Iranians say, we don't know what you're talking about. He did announce that just after the markets had opened, after a pretty grisly couple of days. So who knows where we'll be by the time this goes out. But essentially, what we now know after 4 weeks of war is that they didn't have any contingency planning about what would happen if the Strait of Hormuz got closed. Mm-hmm. They assumed, per a report in the New York Times, that based on Israeli intelligence, it looked like that Iranian protesters would rise up and overthrow the regime, which has so far not happened.
Yeah.
And that they wouldn't at any point have to put kind of boots on the ground.
Boots are now kind of sailing over from...
Boots are hovering over the ground, I would say, at the moment. So, you know, that is an incredibly symbolic thing for America to do. But the main thing about it is the fact that it has really revealed there is no one in this White House who can say no to Donald Trump.
And why is that?
Because they were all hand-selected to be people who wouldn't say no to Donald Trump. Such a question one.
That's
on the
a reasonable
application.
Answer.
Well, but in one way, look at it. One of the qualifications to work in that White House is you have to believe that Donald Trump was grievously robbed of the 2020 election, right? You have to be a kind of reality denier in favour of the cult of, you know, El Presidente. So by saying that, you have to say, you know, you've accepted this one thing. Your loyalty to Trump matters more than the facts. You can kind of see everything else flows from that.
But fact is quite important in the run-up to a war. I mean, the failures of intelligence you've described could be applied to Iraq or some of the other adventures or picnics or whatever. What is the definition for the war at the moment?
I believe it's a charabanc tour.
But again, none of this was unforeseeable. Why did no one mention any of it?
Did he even know about things like, you know, oil going through the Strait of Hormuz? You know, did he think about that? He's making these decisions, isn't he, without talking about anybody. Does it occur to him that, hang on, there's going to be a consequence like that?
They do seem to have been completely caught on the hop by that. I think the way that their intelligence was running was essentially, we'll go in, you know, take out the Ayatollah and the whole thing will collapse like a house of cards. Mm. We'll be back home and sort of tea and medals. And that is obviously not what has happened. The regime has basically said, well, hang on a minute, what's the point of negotiating, right? That's the fascinating thing, is that Donald Trump has been hopping from foot to foot for days now, obviously desperate to negotiate an end to the war that he can claim as another great Donald Trump victory. And the Iranians are the ones who really don't see what's in that for them.
What we have at the moment, as you said, Helen, Donald Trump has just declared that he's spoken to Iran and he now graciously won't bomb energy infrastructure for 5 days, whereas previously it was a 48-hour deadline and the Iranians have said, well, we haven't had that chat, so we don't know who you were talking to. I mean, things are probably quite chaotic at the top of the regime at the moment, obviously.
Well, everyone's got Donald Trump's phone number, so it's quite possible that someone with an Iranian accent has phoned him up claiming to be the Iranian foreign minister, and they've had a very good chat.
But the last time Donald Trump said things were going well in negotiations, I had a little check. It was the 6th of February, if you can remember all the way back then. He said the talks they were having had been very good, and it looks like they want to make a deal very badly. And that was about 3 weeks before he unleashed Armageddon. So maybe his word on how the talks are going is not gospel.
I have this vision of Donald Trump inventing a talk at one end, and at the other end there's an Ayatollah who may or may not be alive, we don't know.
Yeah.
There's a series of men who you see grainy footage of in bunkers who may or may not be talking to each other or to anyone else who's actually in charge of a missile. I'm not quite sure how these talks are happening.
They're clearly not. That's the problem. there's been so much chat wasted on Donald Trump's reasons for doing things as though there are reasons.
But you're right. I mean, it's a crisis for international diplomacy if you end up with a leader that nobody believes a word that they say and they go back on themselves all the time. Yeah. That's the thing. Even if America was sending out very strong signals of being utterly bonkers consistently, that would be something that people could work with. But the problem is that everybody, and you know, I do feel a great deal of sympathy for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves in this, because all of their fiscal plans for the entire year are resting on what Mad King Donald, rampaging down the ha-ha in his white nightshirt flapping behind him, decides to do next.
Although it does give them a bit of a let-out, doesn't it? Because, you know, global turmoil is a bit like COVID and so on. If I were Rachel Reeves, I'd be thinking, phew, you know, at least I'm not going to be held to those plans. You know,
the thing you said about the purity test of saying that, you know, Donald Trump won the 2020 election and that's the sort of threshing machine which you have to pass your brain through in order to be accepted into Donald Trump's inner circle. It's weirdly reminiscent of what happened to the Conservative Party after Brexit, where you had the Boris Johnson cabinet, which was only loyalists. You know, all of the anyone who disagreed was cleared out, you know, the kind of left of the Tory party and the centrists and the people who thought Brexit looks like it might be not a brilliant idea. They were all cleared out.
I think even before then, so for a long time, if you wanted to get selected as a Tory MP during the 2010s or the late 2000s, the question that came up in selection meetings was, what do you think about leaving the European Union? Right. And, you know, it was a very popular thing to say. So you had a lot of people who had never really looked into it or didn't think it was a great idea, but also thought it was never going to happen, just going along with it. No. And I think that is exactly the problem we're seeing repeated, is that people who just think, well, it doesn't matter if I just make this one compromise, actually, no, sometimes that bill does come due.
And how does it happen that the head of counterterrorism, who, from what I'd read, I assumed was pretty much full-on Trump loon, has declared that Trump's a loon? What on earth are we doing here? Why is this man suddenly the new bellwether?
Well, a new type of loon is rising in the East, no, hang on a minute, in the West, actually, which is, he is, Joe Kent we're talking about, resigned, and he made a fair point in the resignation letter, which was a bit about this kind of idea that the US has embarked on a joint war here with Israel, and actually that maybe this might be suiting the Israelis rather than more than the Americans. But he then brought in this other stuff about how his wife was killed in Syria by a suicide bombing, about how that was another Israel-led foreign war. And that shades into lots of things he said in the past that shade into the idea that actually maybe the Jewish state and then maybe by extension Jews are maybe controlling America's foreign policy. All in right. The kind of way that if you saw somebody saying it online, your eyes would go up and go, is this going to just stay as a strictly a critique of foreign policy, or is this going
to end up where I think it is?
In a little bit puppet master hands in the cartoon.
Right.
And I think that is an emerging strain of MAGA. So there are people who are both anti-Israel for very principled reasons, in the sense that they think it is a foreign war adventurism and that America's foreign policy should be dictated by America's interests first and that those don't lie in wars in the Middle East. But there are also some flat-out white supremacists who have glommed on to MAGA, who are anti-Jewish Holocaust deniers. People like Nick Fuentes, who I've mentioned before.
Yeah.
But this has caused, this going into a war with Israel has caused a split in the, what you might call the kind of MAGA elite. So I looked at the polling, and actually, voters who self-identify as MAGA, 90% of them backed strikes on Iran at the start of the war. That may have softened up since then. Only 77% of those who define as Republican back it, right? So being MAGA is being, you know, Donald Trump, right or wrong to some extent. But within the elite, people like Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly, have started to, and the kind of podcast comedian class, so Theo Von, Joe Rogan.
You can't lose the podcast comedians. They're a core demographic.
Right, but they are a core demographic, right? Because they all swung behind Trump in 2024.
Right.
But they have been, to their credit, Joe Rogan is not a big fan of foreign wars in the way that Donald Trump once wasn't.
Right.
And so they, being a little bit more of a distance removed, have been quite critical. I'm just going to read you out something, because just to give you a sense of the level of debate that is currently happening, right? So Mark Levin, very pro-Israel talk radio host, versus Megyn Kelly, ex-Fox News, you'll remember her.
Is anyone involved not in broadcast?
No.
That's the Witten, right, okay.
Everyone is 12 and everyone is a chat show host. Those are the only things you need to know to
that
understand.
That explains so much about the war.
Everything about American politics. Okay, so Megyn Kelly, first of all, attacks Mark Levin, saying, calling him micropenis Mark Levin, right, and saying that's why he's in favour of this war. He then says, busy Sunday morning for Megyn Kelly. She wakes up and has micropenis on her mind. Suffice to say, if it talks like a harlot and posts like a harlot, it's, well, you know the rest, shalom. At which point, Donald Trump thinks, here's a beef I should get involved with.
Oh my God.
And posts on Truth Social defending Levin as a truly great American patriot who is far smarter than those who criticise him.
So the president of the United States has got nothing better to do.
Just weigh in on the great micropenis controversy of 2026. But this is what's happening, is you've basically got a load of, yeah, like cable news hosts. I mean, Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, is a former Fox News host. This is basically a load of preening prima donnas who have somehow accidentally been put in charge of the world's only superpower and its enormous arsenal. And of course, they're all fighting with each other. So the base is still very much with Trump, but he has lost significant portions of the kind of MAGA elite over this.
Can I ask what happened to the army? Are there any generals left? Is there anyone left in command in America who says, I'm not sure about this?
Yeah, or someone's launching these missiles, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Pete Hegseth has been pretty explicit about clearing people out. You know, he went and summoned them all, if you remember, of that lecture about how they weren't allowed to have beards. And, you know, he's been very clear that he wants, you know, he wants a stereotypically masculine military, and he wants one that is not going to gainsay anything that they're ordered to do. So you're right, the big figures of Trump won, like General Mark Kelly, like H.R. McMaster,
gone.
He wasn't going to make the mistake of appointing anybody like that again. And the two things they used to do was, one, they used to tell him to his face things were a bad idea. And two, I think they used to quietly hide his briefing papers and hope he'd forget about it. Also, it turned out a great tactic. But now he's got Marco Rubio, who he used to attack all the time as Little Marco, and just, you know, once said, you know, if you locked him in a room, you know, he could slide under the door, right? Like that's, he would just change all his principles. J.D. Vance, who's been stuffed in a cupboard, and knows that his only lane for 2028 is, as you know, continuity Trump, so he can't break from him. Susie Wiles, as a chief of staff, was picked because she was just there to enable whatever he wants to do. And who in the whole of the Republican Party is a counterweight to him? You know, like Mitt Romney's out of the Senate. You know, there are a couple of senators like Thomas Tillis, who's on his way out, who will vote against his nominee, stand up to him, make criticisms.
Right.
But
none of this matters. The great vaunted American system of checks and balances, it doesn't seem to work at all, does it?
No. Congress, you know, at the moment, if you look online, you will see that there are 2 or 3 hour-long queues at security at American airports. And that's just because of essentially a partial government shutdown in funding. They have this mad idea that you can, like, fund agencies and you keep voting. You know, Congress needs to reapprove funding. And what's happened with that is that the Republicans have attached a load of ICE funding, immigration enforcement funding, to it, which the Democrats don't want to vote through. So while they continue to have this stalemate, people have now got to get to the airport 15 hours early and stand in the car park. Like, there was this line, I think it was PJ O'Rourke used to have, about, you know, Republicans say that government doesn't work and then they set out to prove it. And there is a lot of that in American politics, right? It's just that we just, you know, don't really care that much about government working.
So is it just that it takes so long for these checks and balances, for the courts to act, and, you know, so it's just not effective? Because that was always the line, wasn't it? Oh, don't worry too much about Trump because the checks and balances will kick in.
He's a lot better this time, though. So without getting too conspiratorial. No, I mean...
to disagree.
No, I mean, he's a lot better...
Better at what, Helen?
Okay, getting what he wants, or the people who work for him. So in Stephen Miller, who's effectively his prime minister, you know, he has got a doctrinaire anti-immigration ideologue who is crucially quite well-liked by his staff and really good at bureaucracy, right? He is not a... Although his wife is a podcaster, inevitably, because that's the law. Someone in his family's got a podcast and it's going to have to be you. So, you know, he's got these kind of dry bureaucrats essentially in place now. And thanks to things like Project 2025, which was the Heritage Foundation's blueprint for a second Trump government, he's got a kind of tick list of stuff that he can do, often using executive orders. Mm. You saw the big barrage of them at the start. Lots of those, when they eventually end up at the Supreme Court, will get overturned, but it takes months.
From your point.
And the Supreme Court gets to pick its docket to some extent, so it can pick and choose what it wants to look at. I mean, the midterms are coming up, and that really might be when it changes everything. And also, at that point, lots of Republicans start thinking about their positioning for 2028. Do they want to be left holding this, probably by that point, unpopular failed war? And that might encourage a few of them to grow a tiny whisper of a vertebrae, just a song.
I'm interested you say that there's no one pointing these things out until the head of counterterrorism says, do you think Israel's leading this war? I mean, last week on our letters page... one of our readers, you know, and this is a full 2 weeks ahead, said, I think we should call this the Israel-US Iran war. And I thought, well, that's quite good. That's from one of our readers. Is there no one of that level of competence operating in the White House?
I mean, as I say, most of the people who I think are really competent are on the domestic side of policy. And, you know, the other thing is, I mentioned this before in my column, that you've got Jared Kushner, for example, one of the envoys, and Steve Witkoff. They're also supposed to be doing Ukraine.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a situation now in which the US is also blockading Cuba, right? Cuba has had power cuts intermittently, and they're all kind of going, well, we just... There was a report in Atlantic, my other organisation, saying that they're casting around for a Republican donor with family links to Cuba who might fancy going over and having a crack at being in charge of Cuba.
Sort of being the governor.
I mean, there's a big Republican Florida community of expats who'd love to have a crack at being head of Cuba. They give you your own cigar.
Absolutely.
Your life expectancy is 6 to 8 months.
It's a bit like reform taking over councils here, doesn't it?
A lot warmer.
Yeah. So Trump's cut off the oil to Cuba and opened it again so Iran can sell.
Yes, I wanted to
Richard,
bring this
can
up.
Can you explain this?
So, yes, this is exactly what I wanted to ask. So far as I can tell, there are three beneficiaries of the war. One is the big American oil exporters and producers. Mm. The price has gone up enormously. One is Russia. They'll get a lot more, and they've just had their sanctions lifted. And the third is Iran. The USA seems to have allied with Iran to lift its sanctions to ensure that the prices don't go completely out of control.
Well, this is
going on there.
You know, like we were talking about earlier, just not understanding the consequences of your actions. You know, this is going to hit the oil price. That's going to hit inflation. We didn't really think about that. You know, you go to war in the Middle East and don't think about the effect on the oil price until a bit later. It must be the most, perhaps the only example of one power funding its enemy during a war.
It reminded me a bit of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where Europe is still using a chunk of... I mean, they've tried to diversify a lot away from Russian gas and oil, and I think they'll have completed the job next year, but...
Well, I think they just haven't understood that, you know, the markets are all interconnected. It's not, you know, we don't get our oil from, you know, friendly countries and domestically and you know, Iran just sends it to China and whoever, that it all goes on the same market, and therefore you get this terrible effect on prices. They're not really understood that. And they're not understood the way that we actually help break any kind of ring fence that you might want to set up by using places like Dubai, where Iran can route oil pretty much to wherever it wants through centres like that.
Well, he doesn't understand tariffs, so it's possible he just also willfully misunderstands international markets.
Yeah, and there's a similar sort of, this negotiating tactic with tariffs, where we're going to, you know, if you don't come to the table, we're putting a massive tariff on you. And then the time comes and he sort of delays, oh, no, we'll give you another couple of months. You know, this is the guy who's supposedly, the great negotiator. But what you learn is that actually you can't believe any threat he says doesn't really stand up. The trouble is that if he did go through with those threats, they're so catastrophic.
Well, it seems like a lot of these red lines have already been crossed. I mean, they were in the middle of a negotiation when the war was launched, so why would Iran come to the table to negotiate an end to the war, given that Trump has shown that his word is not to be relied on?
I don't think theirs is either.
No, quite sorry, honest. Sorry,
I'm not entirely sure that the assembled Revolutionary Guard would be that worried about sticking to their negotiating positions either. Now, I'm sure that isn't what you meant. But I mean, the problem seems to be that we're in a phony war where if we are at war with Iran, why are we encouraging them to sell their oil freely and make more money and rearm themselves? Why are we encouraging our so-called allies, and Richard's written about this, to carry on selling Iranian oil, but just doing it slightly under the radar? None of this makes a great deal of sense if we were genuinely at war. No.
Right.
But we have allowed them to become so embedded. That's the issue. You know, yes, it would be great if you could say, Iran, you're not selling any oil, and they're, you know, and they suffer the consequences. But, you know, it's in the system. We've created that system.
Is it international capitalism, Richard?
Yeah, it's the scourge of...
Just checking.
Okay.
I mean, this is, if anything, a resounding sort of cheer for international capitalism, because that's appears to be the only thing that has any restraining value on Donald Trump, right? He obviously made the announcement that he did because he's very worried about inflation and the economy, and particularly American gas prices, which are like a kind of holy value.
I know, they've gone from, American petrol prices have gone from insanely cheap to criminally cheap, and the American people will not put up with those extraordinary prices they're having to... as a Brit, looking at those petrol prices, you think, come on.
I know, but I quite regularly fill up like a big SUV, sorry, close your ears, you don't want to hear this, when I'm driving across America, and I consistently, because my...
You've only charged me for the chocolate bar,
right, because my car doesn't work, like you have to have the special magstripe car and whatever in America, I often have to go in and prepay for the pump, and I'm essentially driving a tank, it's probably going to cost, $50 to fill that up? Right. And then every time, I've massively overestimated. Mm. Did you, about Saturday Night Live, did you see that Donald Trump reposted the Saturday Night Live sketch taking the piss out of Keir Starmer for being afraid of him?
The unkindest cut of all.
No, but that is also kind of reflects that other thing that we've been talking about the Trump's belief that his allies are really not stepped up for him, and he's sort of like, why have you not guys not opened the Strait of Hormuz, you bunch of ingrates?
But petrol prices will go up, as you say, and Americans do drive twice as far with much less efficient cars, so it will affect people there, won't it? Or certain people will feel it in their pockets.
Oh, I mean, it's just an unfathomably vast country, so even just like the logistics of getting food and things around the country have a huge knock-on effect, even if people weren't also driving pickup trucks where the wheels are like that high
But America is more insulated than lots of other places is another element of this whole thing.
Is this because of their shale gas, their fracking?
Well, since the 1973 oil crisis, the oil shock, America was a big net importer at the time, and now they're a big net exporter. That will affect their attitude to it. All the Asian countries are having a dreadful time. I mean, they've already gone to 4-day weeks in various places because they're trying to preserve the stocks they've got. They've set limits on what you can set the air conditioning to because their electricity is gas-based. So there are plenty of countries that are in a mad scramble at the moment to try and deal with this and not knowing when full supplies will be resumed. So,
and there is a feeling that, and old Sparky was writing it for us, is that it's a big crisis, but it's particularly a crisis if you're a poor country because the remaining stocks you'll be outbid. The rich countries will buy the liquefied gas, they'll buy whatever there is, and if you're Bangladesh, it's going to be a bit grim. We have a war in which the richest Western country, America, is saying, well, we can keep this war going. Yes. You're thinking, what about the rest of the world?
Yeah. So we spoke last time on the show about what happened in Pakistan after Russia invaded Ukraine in relation to their energy system. Pakistan since then had a bit of a solar revolution where they've imported huge numbers, like gigawatts and gigawatts of solar. That has changed Pakistan's economy to a greater extent than Bangladesh's, where Bangladesh is still very reliant.
I float a new conspiracy theory, though?
Yeah.
Which is that Trump is actually being controlled by Greta Thunberg. Because this war is just a giant advert for, like, defossilizing your economy.
I like that theory.
He's actually, all this time, he's been a mole. He's been an incredibly deep cover.
You know, just putting the, reformy alternative. Perhaps it's an advert for having, emergency supplies of your own.
Maybe we should drill the North Sea. I'm just going to float the idea.
It is about energy security. I mean, it does show, the importance of security.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's funny because every time these crises happen, and they do keep happening, the alternatives are looking better economically. You know, things like battery storage, which is probably down by about half since 2022. I mean, the costs of the alternatives keep on changing. China is the fourth beneficiary of this war, really, because I think a lot of countries will be looking at their plans for big expansions of natural gas and thinking, maybe we could just do a bit of solar and storage. Quite sunny here. Storage is quite cheap now. But we'll drill the North Sea and we'll be all right.
That's the default opposition position at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why don't we just drill the North Sea?
And it's kept happening since we. I thought
since
we put
your
this,
podcast
we
put, when you explained how that wouldn't work.
Put this to bed 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. No, you keep putting it to bed,
and it keeps on getting up again. Yeah, yeah.
It's almost as though Kemi Badenoch wasn't listening to you, Andy.
I can't believe that. I've spoken this morning to more people involved in the.
I thought you were going to say Kemi Badenoch.
No, she's not picking up. It is an interesting one because lots of people are putting the case that we need everything all at once. You know, we need to do everything to ensure stability and security. But a lot of the sides of the debate will say, well, we need to do everything except the thing I've chosen we shouldn't do. So if you're Kemi Badenoch or Richard Tice or Nigel Farage, you say, well, we need to do everything. But let's not do the renewables, which is basically an argument for doing the North Sea, you know. And again, there's a case for doing it if you want to maybe nationalise the industry. That would be an option.
What about a lovely nuclear power plant?
Yeah, 10 years from now, terrific. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you mean, 10?
Yeah. Sorry, 20.
How naive is that?
Yeah. It's so interesting because governments keep on having these shocks. And that, you know, we had the shock in 2022. Rishi Sunak's, one of his next moves was to say, well, let's roll back the electric car mandate. Let's go slower. Let's keep our reliance on this stuff for longer. The government's initial package has been pretty decent. What they've said is very short term. If you're struggling with heating oil, because lots of houses use heating oil still, we're going to support you, but in a targeted way because they're not yet countenancing the idea of supporting everyone's bills again.
I'm not sure we can sustain that, can we?
It doesn't seem like it.
Borrowing's quite difficult at the moment, isn't it, Richard?
The trouble is that, it's very difficult to get back to normal in the meantime. And often sort of counterproductive because you say, well, we've really got to rein in now. We've got to cut that debt to get that interest down and so on. Then you end up not putting money into various things. Now we're talking about not enough going into defence, for example. You don't actually address the problems. Like COVID, we weren't prepared in the health service. This crisis has come along. We've got a couple of dinghies we can send over. We're not prepared for this one.
Let's hope the next crisis is in the arts.
Unfortunately, the arts are always in crisis. There's no solution there. Can I say one more quick thing about energy?
Yes.
Just that no matter who you talk to all over, everyone's solution is the same, which is lower the price of electricity. For people who simply want bills to be lower, like the Reform or the Conservative lot, removing levies from electricity bills and maybe putting them into general taxation, maybe scrapping them, whatever, they have different proposals. But that cheapens people's bills. For people who actually want the transition to happen, where I put myself in that camp, that making the electricity price lower encourages people to adopt these solutions, and we've already largely made the electricity grid green, but there's so much elsewhere, mostly the cars we drive and how we heat our homes, that is remaining to be greened. It is security.
We start off with the Iran war. I knew we'd end up at cross pavement charging solutions.
No. heat pumps and electric cars are the electric. They are stability. They're basically
security.
Did I follow
that? You were saying that essentially the populist view of get the bills down because we want to pay less is actually a positive green incitement.
I think getting the bills down means more people will be encouraged to adopt these solutions.
Yep.
I think Reform and the Conservatives have said various things like we're going to scrap net zero targets, we're going to scrap heat pump incentives. I think it would not be good for the climate in the long run or emissions. But getting the electricity price down seems to be the thing everyone can agree on because you make these solutions even more economically compelling, more people will adopt them. If you can fill up an electric car for £7 and your diesel's just gone up to £100, it becomes more convincing. So, that seems to be the thing we should bear in mind for next time this happens, which will be in about 2 years, apparently.
Yeah.
So now we come to the exciting world of finance. Richard, you write the In the Money column, and there have been a few stories recently, both in your column and across the rest of the press, about a little upstart party called Reform. The very innovative things that they're doing with money, things like them receiving donations in the form of crypto, it seems to be a really vibrant area. And
they're at the cutting edge of this.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Can you tell us what gives?
Yeah, well, they've said they...
Or who gives?
Yes. Well, that's the point. We can't. Yeah. Right. Or we're not sure. They've said that they've started taking crypto donations, but none are actually recorded yet. If they are, they're getting washed through the crypto system and turned into real money. And that process doesn't give you any great confidence in where the money originally came from. Now, there's no, we haven't got a case where we can say, ah, oh, that money you said came from right. Mr. X actually came from Mrs. Y. But that's what it potentially allows you to do. And that's why there are people arguing for banning crypto donations or donations that originate with crypto. The government shows no signs of doing that. It's quite pro-crypto as well.
God, I thought we weren't so pro-crypto. I mean, obviously, the Trump family is massively pro-crypto. Yeah. They, you know, had this big stake in World Liberty Financial. They sold to Qatar just before Inauguration Day. Donald Trump Jr. is at every shady-looking crypto conference in the Middle East. Well, actually, that's probably really knackered their business model for shady-looking crypto conferences in the Middle East. But I sort of thought we were maintaining what I'd like to think of as a kind of slightly more useful reserve. But is that not true? Britain is gung-ho for crypto as well.
Well, we're saying that we want to regulate it properly in order to have a, you know, a healthy, responsible crypto industry. But the question is whether that, you know, there really is such a thing. You know, if you look at who uses this stuff for real purposes, as opposed to just kind of hoarding it and hoping it goes up in value, pornography,
drugs,
anything, money laundering, it's hard to find. And, you know, you even find, we wrote a piece a couple of issues ago about the guy who runs the payment processing company that Reform are using, and he was at a conference saying, oh, you know, we've got pornography covered, we've got we've got the drugs covered, we're looking for some decent purposes for people to use our product. You know, they just haven't really got it. If you want to do something legitimate with money, why don't you just use ordinary money?
Right. You use a bank, as we like to call them. And you get deposit protection insurance, right? As a consumer, you get up to something like £85,000 you have in a bank account. The government will back that if the bank goes under. If you lose the keys to your crypto
laptop.
Wallet or someone steals it, no one is coming to save you. Like, I extreme caution is how I feel about crypto.
No, I mean, there was that famous case of the guy who's... The Bitcoin or whatever had gone up in value so much, he tried to buy the whole
waste dump from the council.
Yeah. Said, I'll give you millions for this.
But Nigel Farage can't use ordinary banks, can he?
He was debanked. He was by Coutts, but I think that was an interesting one that I'm not saying he rigged it, but it came at a very useful time for him to use it as a, and this is why.
Oh, right.
You know, because he was also very into gold, right? Like, he sold gold through his newsletter. So the part of the, of the political ecosystem that he's appealing to is very low trust in institutions.
Yeah.
And then, so the message to sell crypto has always been, don't trust the banks. You know, have your crypto. Keep, like, it's money that can't be regulated, can't be overseen.
I have to say, turning I was debanked by Coutts into your pitch to people to not trust institutions is quite good politics, I've got to say. It's quite cleverly done.
And he's certainly going strong on both gold and crypto. He's got this big gig with the gold company, this direct bullion company, who are paying him, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds. Not that he's necessarily used that money, but he's put a very similar amount of money into a crypto company whose largest shareholder is the guy who's paid him all that money for endorsing gold.
Is this separate to Kwasi Kwarteng's?
Well, no, it's not. This is the Kwasi Kwarteng
crypto
Bitcoin company.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is described
is it
as
called
a sort
that?
Of...
Because I would suggest that's not a very good name to market.
Why is it not called Kwasi's Crypto?
It's
crazy.
It's allied with the Trust Investment Management Company. Kwasi Kwarteng and this chap Paul Withers have joined up to create this company called Stack Bitcoin, which is a Bitcoin treasury company, which means they'll look after your Bitcoin.
But it's nothing to do with the treasury.
No,
I'm just checking.
You seem quite alarmed by this. Aren't there rules about what you? There are rules about you can't just say this is the king's crypto company or whatever. You're just allowed to stick treasury on it.
You can use the word treasury. Yeah.
Well, I think the rules need tightening up.
Questionable whether Kwasi Kwarteng should ever use the word treasury again. But
I think that's
they
a
do.
Good question.
So Farage gets the money from the gold company. He puts it into the crypto company that the gold guy's involved in, and this crypto company shares. leaps up, which is all, you know, very convenient.
That's what I'm really interested in, because exactly as you say, when he announced, I think it was £215,000 he'd invested stack company. The value then leaps. He's got various options, which mean that if the value of this company goes above a certain amount, he will make a huge amount of money. But obviously, he's using his status as a public figure to drive up the value of the coin. I mean, it's very... this is the thing about crypto.
You're looking for an adjective, and Richard has already said convenient.
Sorry.
So if you don't want the lawyers to have to spend the next 35 minutes, can we just say convenient?
Yeah.
As in public convenience.
But that's the kind of the point of crypto, though, right? Is it some respects it's trading on reputation and trading on speculation. Yeah. Nobody buys crypto really as a safe haven. They buy it because they think they're going to the moon. Yeah. And like the thing that annoys
I wish they would.
Well, no, but the thing that annoys people like me, I made a podcast about this once, was the fact that it has delivered a huge amount of returns for like for everybody who was the early investors. I mean, and there's a weird analogy to some of the other stuff. Like, remember when they took the post office public and they sold off the early things and then immediately it spiked up. So everybody who got in the early distribution made absolute bank.
Well, it's like any other bubble. Yes, a lot of people make money on it. And a lot of people make money knowing that it's a bubble, knowing that there's no substance to it.
Yeah.
But they just hope they get out before
they think the other people
everybody
are the
else realises that.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this could go on ages. Where the public figure's a politician, you'd think, well, that's a bit off, really, using your, you know, political profile to boost the company. But, you know, in this case, they're boasting of that. Quartin saying, oh, it's wonderful to have a frontline politician, as he described Farage. Combining this sort of financial bubble with political fortunes and saying, yeah, come on, let's froth it all up. It's a bit like Trump, really. On a slightly smaller scale. We're not in the billions yet.
But Farage has said he wants the Bank of England to have a Bitcoin reserve, and he wants to slash the tax on Bitcoin transactions or cryptocurrency deals, cut by more than half. Is there an intellectual underpinning to this, or is there...
I thought you were about to suggest, is the fact that he's advocating a policy that will benefit both him and all his friends, is that in some way convenient? And I think the answer is yes. I think it is very convenient, Andy.
The intellectual underpinning is that people like Christopher Harborne like it, his biggest donor, and therefore he gives him millions.
This is the Thailand-based
who's given Reform Party more than £20 million. Coincidentally, Farage, you know, favours tax breaks and so on for crypto.
It is an enormous amount as a donor, isn't it? I know you frequently catalogue who gives Reform money. Nick Candy, he's the treasurer, isn't he?
Famous former tax exile, made a lot of money while he was offshore through cashing in on One Hyde Park and so on. We report a couple of others in the latest issue. Using companies in the UK that are owned by British Virgin Island companies. So again, we're not quite sure where the money's coming from. The companies in the UK are losing money, so it can't be coming entirely from them. And there's various other offshore donors. There's another chap called Basim Haidar, a Nigerian-Lebanese businessman, who's very vocal in wanting non-dom tax breaks to come back in. And has become one of Nigel's new close friends, accompanying him to Mar-a-Lago and so on.
I just think that's so public-spirited of these businessmen who don't live here. They don't, you know, they could just not get involved if they wanted to have an easy life. I think it's amazing that they're doing this for our politics.
It all just it makes me feel so Maoist. I'm sorry, it really does. I just really, really seriously object to it. And having it yoked to this populist party. So Matt Goodwin, former candidate of Reform, you know, he's been in a bit of hot water over his book and people questioning the sourcing of that. And he's gone instantly to, you snooty libs are trying to take me down, right?
Right.
And to have a group of people who are a kind of a front to some extent for offshore money and a series of tax reforms that will benefit extremely wealthy people, saying that the only people who oppose me must be this sort of metropolitan elite, just gets on my nerves. Something chronic really does.
I found the fact that Richard Tice avoids quite a lot of tax quite convenient. How does he do that, Richard?
Well, he did. He's been stopped from doing it now, but he did.
But they can't do anything nowadays.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Was let's just say it was £600,000 he managed to avoid in tax, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a property man, and he decided to do it a bit more tax efficiently. Labour government in 2007 had introduced a new type of property investment company called a real estate investment trust. The idea behind it was that lots of different types of investors would come together, pool their money and invest in property, and we wanted to encourage that. Mm. The vehicle they pooled their money in wouldn't be taxable. So it was intended for like big pool investments, like fund managers look after and so on, not for small family property companies based in Mayfair. But Richard Tice found a way, looking at the rules, of saying we are a REIT, so can we have the tax break? Happy days. And the revenue did allow them that status for a while.
Okay.
I think because they must have, or they claimed they were looking for other investors, which, funnily enough, didn't come off.
Right.
And then that was it.
So the revenue has now stopped this?
Yes, they've lost that status. So it's £600,000, which is quite a lot of money.
Yes, and you pointed out in the last issue that it's quite a lot more than many of the shirkers that Mr. Tice and his party have been pointing us towards.
That's the thing. I mean, this crowd, if they specialise in anything, it's gaming the system. Yet the things they're probably most exercised about among other people is gaming the system. You know, they hate the idea of people being on benefits and so on.
Or making a couple of hundred quid more than they should.
Yeah, benefits are okay if they're sort of six figures.
I think I find it quite worrying, because I think, I've got, as you'll have heard on this podcast, quite a few criticisms of Keir Starmer. I don't think he would front a crypto company. I don't think Theresa May would have done. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn would have done. I don't think Gordon Brown certainly would have done. Tony Blair, let's put a question mark over that one. Maybe I would have waited until he left office, right? So the populist drift of that, I think, really bothers me, that the erosion of the idea of conflicts of interest and the idea that you're in public life. Because, as you say, the whole value of that crypto company is about, as it was said, he is a frontline politician. Mm. It's a version of what Mandelson was selling as, it's context. Yeah. That doesn't work unless you're in politics. Mm. So it is, to me, an inherent conflict of interest. And as you say, very, very convenient.
Well, I'm going to find the OED first thing after this recording's over and ask them to add a new definition for the word convenient. Thank you so much for watching this podcast or listening to it. If you would like to find out many more of the brilliant stories we've been running, from Richard's In the Money column to Old Sparky's Reflections on the World of Oil and Gas and the Energy System, and so much more besides, you can get a copy of Private Eye by going into a shop and buying one, or by going to private-eye.co.uk and subscribing, which is very reasonably priced. I mean, Richard Tice could buy himself several thousand subscriptions to the magazine with the money he's saved. So, Richard, if you're watching, we know you do. Yeah. Why not do that?
But it may go up in value as well as down.
Or down. Your old private eyes will never go down in value, and we guarantee that. Thanks to Helen, Ian and Richard, and as always to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.